What's Universe Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A suspected Syrian chemical attack is believed to have killed scores of people in the town of Khan Shaykhun in northwest Idlib province. The Syrian military denied any involvement, but White House spokesman Sean Spicer placed blame on President Bashar al-Assad, as well as the policies of President Donald Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama.
President Obama said in 2012 that he would establish a quote-unquote red line against the use of chemical weapons and then did nothing. The United States stands with our allies across the globe to condemn this intolerable act.
Tuesday's attack, believed to involve sarin gas, was the worst instance of chemical weapons use in Syria since 2013. UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura was attending a conference on Syria's future in Brussels when he heard the news.
Every time we have a moment in which the international community is capable of being together, 70 countries tomorrow, there is someone, somehow, that tries to undermine that feeling of hope by producing a feeling of horror and outrage. But we are not going to give up.
A UN Security Council meeting is scheduled for Wednesday. The U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley Tuesday called on Sudan to do a better job caring for its own citizens as a way of drawing down the UN peacekeeping mission.
This council needs to see the Sudanese government do far more to provide for its people by meeting the agreed-upon benchmarks for Darfur, supporting an inclusive peace process, protecting civilians, and preventing community violence. It is not enough for the government to promise to do better. We need to see proof.
She spoke as UN officials reviewed the 10-year mandate of the 17,000-strong joint UN-African Union force known as UNAMID. This is VOA News. Just a day before a U.S.-China summit is scheduled in Florida, North Korea launched another intermediate-range ballistic missile into waters off its east coast Wednesday. Troy Stangerone is an analyst with the Korea Economic Institute.
What we need to do is, at the upcoming summit meeting with China, stress to President Xi that this is something that we need to resolve, that the time is running out, but that's more of a private conversation than a public one.
North Korea's missile and nuclear threat expected to be high on the agenda of Thursday's and Friday's meetings in Florida between Presidents Trump and Xi Jinping of China. This is the latest in a series of missile launches by Pyongyang in recent weeks. The U.S. Pacific Command identified the latest missile as a KN-15 medium-range rocket, last test launched in February. In Iraq, the U.N. said Tuesday it was expanding camps for people fleeing the fighting in Mosul. Some 300,000 have fled the city since the start of an Iraqi campaign to wrest control from Islamic State in October. Iraqi forces have already captured the eastern half of the city. They're contesting the western side. Meanwhile, President Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, accompanying the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Tuesday said he's optimistic about long-term security arrangements with Iraq. He visited the Hammam el-Alil base on the final day of a two-day visit, that base located just 16 kilometers from Mosul. In Venezuela Tuesday, clashes erupted between security forces and protesters opposed to the rule of socialist president Nicolas Maduro. Opposition leader and Miranda governor Enrique Capriles called for unity. He said Mr. Maduro has picked the path of dictatorship and Venezuelans must unite to oppose it. Tensions heightened after the Supreme Court ruled last week, rendering the opposition-led National Assembly virtually powerless. That has drawn domestic and international condemnation. Russian authorities Tuesday said a Russian suicide bomber from Kyrgyzstan detonated Tuesday's explosives at a St. Petersburg metro train station, killing 14, wounding dozens. He said he had Islamist links. So far, there's been no claim of responsibility. Kyrgyz officials identified the suspect as Akbarjan Jalilov, who was born in the city of Osh in 1995. Reuters reports South Sudanese soldiers attacked the residents of the village of Pajak. Witnesses who managed to escape to Uganda told of soldiers armed with machine guns unleashing a slaughter of civilians that lasted hours. The UN has warned of ethnic cleansing used by both sides in the civil war. U.S. plane maker Boeing Tuesday said it agreed to sell 30 of its 737 jets to Iran's Asaman Airlines, a deal worth $3 billion. This is the second deal Boeing has struck with Tehran following the 2015 nuclear agreement. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There's more political turmoil in South Africa as the country's credit is downgraded to junk status.
We acknowledge that yesterday's announcement was a setback. Despite our current challenges, now is not a time for despondency. We have many strengths that we can leverage to grow our economy inclusively.
The South Africa's new finance minister, Malusi Gigaba. The Red Cross says African countries have fallen short on their commitments to internally displaced people. Veterinarians try to save Somalia's livestock as drought deepens in the country, and Gambians vote tomorrow Thursday in parliamentary elections.
These will be the first elections in over 22 years without Yahya Jammeh as president. There's quite a lot of unknowns about how well the different coalition parties will perform because they are not competing together.
Steve Coburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. Traders in South Sudan's Imatong state are closing shops due to bad economy and insecurity. And Britain is accused of whitewashing colonial history as it seeks post-Brexit trade. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Recent political turmoil in South Africa has come at a cost, with rating agency S&P Global saying a controversial cabinet reshuffle and growing pressure on the president to resign have lowered the country's sovereign credit rating to junk status. Economists predict this will result in higher interest rates and higher prices on imported goods. The political turmoil further deepened on Tuesday when the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, an ally of the ruling African National Congress, called on President Jacob Zuma to step down. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The ratings agency did not mince words in its downgrade announcement, pinning the blame for South Africa's poor credit rating squarely on controversial political decisions made by President Jacob Zuma. On Tuesday, new Finance Minister Malusi Gigaba reassured the nation that under his leadership, South Africa's economy would remain steady.
We acknowledge that yesterday's announcement was a setback. Despite our current challenges, now is not a time for despondency. We have many strengths that we can leverage to grow our economy inclusively.
News of the downgrade has sent the currency, the rand, tumbling. Top ratings agency Moody's has also said it is considering downgrading South Africa, a move which will likely scare away international investors over fears that the nation won't be able to honor its debts. The latest dust-up began last week, when the president suddenly announced sweeping changes to his cabinet. The reshuffle included the dismissal of a well-regarded finance minister, who had challenged the president, as well as several other ministers who openly called for Zuma to resign as he sank deeper in public opinion amid long-simmering corruption scandals. The cabinet changes were met with widespread disapproval, and not just from the usual suspects. In a rare break of party unity, Zuma's own deputy president and the secretary general of the party Zuma leads, the African National Congress, publicly criticized the reshuffle. But, says Associate Economics Professor Christopher Malikane of the University of the Witwatersrand, this downgrade could take pressure off South Africa to strive for the same financial policy goals as developed nations. South Africa's history of oppression has left it with high levels of inequality, largely along racial lines, which is something the ANC has long vowed to address through a program of radical economic transformation. This downgrade, Malikane says, could free up the government to do just that.
The silver lining aspect of it, in my view, has to do with the fact that this thing is now behind us. Now that the downgrade has occurred, I think it's a green light. We can now proceed and transform the economy in a radical way, but in a transparent and well-articulated, clear way, so that investors know what concretely is going to happen going forward.
Political analyst Ralph Matega says he thinks Zuma and his supporters will dodge the fallout from this downgrade by simply reframing the argument.
The rating agencies are working on the paradigm that the ANC is beginning to reject openly, or at least some within the ANC. And by the end of the week, you're going to have to discuss whether we like it or not. The discussion will be that should we actually even worry about the rating agencies.
The political turmoil is sure to continue. Zuma is facing growing clamor from the opposition for a no-confidence vote in parliament. which gained more momentum after the country's top trade union coalition, a longtime ally of the ANC, said Tuesday that they, too, want him to resign. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Gambians go to the polls tomorrow, Thursday, in parliamentary elections, the first since the inauguration of Adama Barrow. As many as 239 candidates are competing for the country's 53 parliamentary seats. Steve Colburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa, was in the Gambian capital, Banjul, this week as campaigns wrapped up. He says the National Assembly is still dominated by former President Yahya Jammeh's APRC party. Colburn tells viewers Reki Shriak that if President Barrow hopes to reverse some of the oppressive laws instituted under Jammeh, it would help if the coalition of political parties that brought him to power gain a majority in the National Assembly.
These will be the first elections in over 22 years without Yahya Jammeh as president. It remains to be seen what happens on Thursday. There's quite a lot of unknowns about how well the different coalition parties will perform because they are not competing together like they did in the presidential elections. It's not clear how strong Jammeh's party will be without him, the APRC. And there's a new party called the GDC, a lot of the Fulani communities who got 17% in the presidential elections, and they are a new force, and it remains to be seen how strong they will be. So the balance of power in the new parliament is what's up for grabs. And then after those parliamentary elections, that's when the government will be able to start its reform of the various laws, the various repressive laws that the Gambians had in place for many years, and see if they could fulfill their promise to abolish those laws and to create a freer country.
Let's talk about some of those laws. Can you give me a few specific examples of laws that, as a human rights advocate, you think Gambia needs to change?
Yeah, a series of laws that would need to be changed to improve protection for freedom of expression. For example, there's what's called the Information and Communications Act, where there are prison sentences for publishing false news. And that has been used in the past to target journalists who have published things that the government disagreed with. There are still a law against sedition, which has been used in the past against dissidents of the governments. There is the Public Order Act. There is a number of provisions that prevents protests and rallies being done without authorization, and that was used in the past very often to prevent and then clamp down on protests of the opposition parties. I mean, all the parties in the coalition have confirmed that they want to change those laws. And I guess what would need to make that happen would be for those parties to have a majority in the National Assembly. And of course, some of those laws may also be supported by some members of the APRC now as well. So I think most people are quite confident that there would be a parliamentary majority to reform those laws. And there's certainly like a strong political will from the president and also from key ministers.
You've been in Banjul. What's the mood in the city? Is there an excitement like there was surrounding after the presidential election?
The atmosphere certainly seems a lot calmer than the presidential elections. No one is really fearing any state repression. No, there's no state censorship or banning of rallies. There has been some incidents between supporters of different parties in quite isolated instances. And the other thing you can see that's, I think, different from in the previous election is there's a very heavy or very significantly larger foreign election observation missions.
That was Steve Colburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa, who was speaking to Reki Shriak from Dakar, Senegal. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. A Red Cross report says African countries are falling short on their commitments to internally displaced people. How to reverse that trend was the subject of a high-level meeting of the International Red Cross and the African Union that wrapped up on Tuesday in Zimbabwe. Sebastian Mofu has the story for VOA from Harare.
Africa has about 13 million internally displaced people, a third of the global number of IDPs, and more than double the amount of refugees on the continent. A refugee has fled across a national border, while an IDP has also fled their home but stayed within their own country. African Union Commission Head of Humanitarian Affairs, Refugees and Displaced People, Olabis Dare, says the situation of IDPs in Africa is very critical, dire, and worsening.
the issues that are generating internal displacement multiplying and deepening by the day. One of the key things is that some situations are protracted situations. We are talking about displacement in countries like Sudan, Somalia, Democratic Republic. For some time, as a result of dwindling conflicts, internal conflicts on the continent, the numbers went down. But again, it went up because of new situations. And here we are talking about Boko Haram situation and the Malian situation.
Dare spoke to VOA on the sidelines of this week's meeting in Zimbabwe to look at how African nations can better implement the Kampala Convention. Created in 2009, the AU Convention binds governments to protect the rights and well-being of IDPs forced to flee their homes by conflict, violence, disasters, and human rights abuses. Just 25 of the 55 AU member states have signed and ratified the convention. But in a report this week, the International Committee of the Red Cross says African countries are coming up short on those commitments. The ICRC presented 25 recommendations for improvements, including dialogue with IDP communities to ensure their meaningful participation in elections and other decision making. ICRC Global IDP Advisor Angela Cotroneo played a key role in the recent research and consultation with the African Union.
Internally displaced persons in situations of armed conflict are often among the most vulnerable civilians. The ICC is present in Africa in many countries, and we also experience every day the difficult situations of IDPs. Very often they lack access to essential services such as healthcare, education, employment.
She said governments need to seek out input from vulnerable groups to ensure their needs are met. The experts agree African countries must also address the root causes of internal displacement, which is in most cases armed conflict. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Traders in South Sudan's Imaton State's county of Mangui are closing their shops because they say they cannot afford to stay open any longer due to the country's deteriorating economy. The traders also say they are closing their shops because their store shelves are nearly empty and insecurity along the roads has hurt business. Dimo Silva Arilio has the report from Torit.
Shop owners in Magui County say the high exchange rate of the US dollar and Uganda shillings is making it nearly impossible to import goods. This week they had to buy 100 US dollars at 14,000 South Sudanese pounds. And to buy 2,500 Ugandan shillings to pay for Ugandan goods, a trader must pay up to 100 South Sudanese pounds for their currency exchange rate. Unlike David Olympio sells various goods in his shop in Magui town. Olympio says many of his customers blame traders for increasing commodity prices each day. Olympio says he plans to close down his shop in a few weeks if the economic crisis continues.
The exchange rate nowadays is keep on increasing. Sometimes you'll get a dollar with 12,000, sometimes with 14,000, 15,000. In that way, it has actually hindered our progress in business. The price keep on increasing. You'll see when you go to Juba, very early morning, you'll get a different price. Reaching to evening is a different price. And the next day is also a different price.
Olympio also complains that men in military uniform have set up several roadblocks along the roads, demanding unofficial taxes from traders bringing in goods. He says the men do not issue receipts for the so-called taxes they levy on traders.
We have so many checkpoints on the way. Coming from Juba up to Magui, maybe you'll get even more than 10 checkpoints. And these checkpoints need you to pay all the money. So any checkpoint, maybe 500, you go to that one, 200 something, you go to another one, 1,000. All this will also contribute to the problem facing us here.
A trader in Magui town who prefers to be identified only as Anthony for security reasons says he is closing his shop because he no longer earns any profit.
Most of our things we bring from Uganda or Kenya, but now it is hard to move with money. Even if you see my shop here now, it doesn't have a lot of quantities. Unless we have dollars, and to get dollars here is very hard now.
Ayela Joseph is a retail trader in Magui Town. He sells soap, salt, sweets, biscuits, and other small items. Joseph began his business in 2007. Back then, he says his shop was always fully stocked. Today, he sells only a few items, sitting in his store for hours alone.
The problem of the road, which is bad, the price of dollars is now high. Prices of goods is now high. That is why our businesses now decline.
Ben Loduk, the Magui County Commissioner, acknowledges that many shops in Magui have closed down due to insecurity and South Sudan's deteriorating economy.
Most of the businesses have closed. The issue of hard currency is one of them. You cannot import without this hard currency.
Loduk says there is no immediate solution to remedy the situation unless peace comes to South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
As Britain begins the process of leaving the European Union, it is trying to rekindle old trade links with Commonwealth countries. But the push for newcomers has sparked a debate on the historical legacy of the British Empire, with accusations that ministers are trying to whitewash atrocities committed during colonial times. Henry Richwell reports from London.
British Chancellor Philip Hammond arrived in India for a three-day trip to, in his government's words, bang the drum for British business. The quest for new Commonwealth trade links has been dubbed Empire 2.0. International Trade Secretary Liam Fox, also on a trade mission in the Philippines, wrote on Twitter recently that Britain is one of the few European countries that does not need to bury its 20th century past. Indian lawmaker and former UN Under-Secretary General Shashi Tharoor has just written a book titled Inglorious Empire. He has a different assessment of Britain's colonial conduct.
Of which the highlights, but only the highlights, include the Jallianwala Bagh massacre in Amritsar in India, which killed defenseless unarmed women, children and men. The use of chemical weapons in Mesopotamia, the air bombing of a number of innocent civilians in Basra. You have the horrendous partition of India. You have the cruelty with which the Mau Mau insurrection was put down in Kenya. The list is endless.
Despite that history, Tharoor says India is listening carefully to what Britain has to offer.
The idea that Commonwealth countries represent a possible alternative area for preferential free trade agreements is welcome, provided, of course, as in every negotiation, there is give and take.
And Tharoor says Britain must give more if it wants to benefit. India is critical of tightening visa restrictions on its citizens wanting to work in Britain. In the kitchen of his award-winning restaurant just outside London, Chef Inam Ali adds the final ingredients to his Balti curry, a favourite on the menu. Embraced during colonial times, curry is known as Britain's national dish. Many working in the $5.6 billion industry backed Brexit, hoping it would open the door to more migration from Commonwealth countries. Ali says he feels betrayed and warns the industry is in trouble.
We feel it would be fair policy. We can able to bring people from outside the EU, from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, where people can come and look after our business because industry needs chefs desperately. So this is something now is happening opposite because the people we are currently working on, helping hand for the European worker, Romanian, Polish, they are not going to leave. And so where we end up with is nobody to work for us.
Cutting migration was a central pledge of Britain's campaign to leave the European Union. But countries like India want visa restrictions relaxed as part of any trade deal. Indian lawmakers say they are open to rekindling old trade links, but in the 21st century, Britain will no longer dictate terms. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the reappointment of Kwesi Appiah as Ghana national football team coach 2 years after he was fired from the same job. Ghana Black Stars has been without a coach since the contract of former coach Avram Grant ended with the 2017 Gabon African Cup of Nations. The Ghana Football Association president, Kwesi Nyatasi, said Appiah will also take charge of the national team for locally based players and has been offered a 2-year contract to start work on the 1st of May.
Kwesi Appiah was chosen on merit. He was not chosen because he's a Ghanaian. Out of the 95 people who applied, later the 3 people who were interviewed, we thought he was the best. So he won on merit, not because he's our countryman.
Chelsea of England may well have to cope without injured Nigerian star Victor Moses for their crunch big fixture in the English Premier League against Manchester City later tonight. The Super Eagles man has been struggling with a calf injury he sustained in the Blues' FA Cup win over Manchester United in March. Chelsea coach Antonio Conte was not sure the Nigerian star, who has played a vital role in their campaign this season, will be available for selection.
I don't know if it'll be available or not, but we have another day to check the situation. We have another day for check the situation in the right way. A couple of situations that we have to check and then to make the best decision for the start 11.
In athletics news, 2-time Olympic silver medalist Paul Tergat gained the support of Kenya's most important sports federations on Tuesday in his bid to become head of the country's troubled Olympic Committee. The Track and Field, Soccer and Rugby federations announced their support for Tergat, as did 6 other sports, as Paul Tergat launched his campaign for the presidency of the National Olympic Committee of Kenya.
As a member of the International Olympic Committee, an Olympian, and one who has actively been involved in some of the activities of the Games, I believe I have what it takes to become the president of the National Olympic Committee. And that is why I've decided maybe to stand for this seat, because I believe in one, that there should be an accountability of anything that we do and transparency.
The election is due for May 5, where he is expected to challenge current Kenyan Olympic head Kip Keno. And finally, South African national rugby team, the Springboks, are currently having their 2nd of 3 scheduled camps in Stellenbosch. Buck coach Alistair Kotze says he is happy to have defensive coach Brendan Venter on board and the experience that he brings.
It's quite a number of things. So we're looking at the injuries, we look at the conditioning of the players, because there is a national conditioning strategy at the moment.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Authorities in southern Somalia are searching for 4 men working on a polio vaccination campaign who were kidnapped by suspected Al-Shabaab militants. The 2 aid workers and 2 drivers, all Somali nationals, were abducted on Sunday near the town of Luke in the Gedo region. They were believed to be working on a program funded by the World Health Organization, but hired by local authorities. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres deeply regrets the United States' decision to cut funding to the UN Population Fund, which provides life-saving care to millions of women and girls around the world. The Trump administration said Monday it will no longer fund the program because it has determined that it participates in the management of a program, coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization, in China. A spokesman for Guterres said Tuesday the UN chief believes this decision is based on an inaccurate perception. And that's it for this Wednesday, April 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
We'll discuss Against All Odds, a book written by Cameroonian lawyer Angela Kwemo. It's a practical guide to making the most of your God-given talents and using them to better yourself, your country, Africa, and the human race. That's all on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.